afternoon, Emily White and Carl Jung, and the topic today is balancing opposites, the law of opposites. Welcome to Holden, all of you are new, and I'll try to give about a half hour talk and then open it to discussion. And if you have any questions, don't be afraid to interrupt. I have been talking about dreams and how we remember dreams, why it is important to remember dreams, about dream symbols and symbols of the self. And if there are any things that you don't understand or that I have covered before, I will start again next week with dream symbols. So either come to the sessions next week or listen to the tapes. There are already about 6 tapes on this. Today I want to talk about one main topic, and that is the law of opposites, which pervades all of life, and certainly the psyche is no exception. And there's a fancy name on the board, for those of you who want to have something to more than just superficial knowledge, it's called enantiodromia, I think it's Greek, and it means the reconciliation of opposites. Opposites can never be really quite united, except very temporarily. But they can be reconciled. You can bear the tension in your psyche. And our life is surrounded by these opposites, the obvious ones being life, birth and death. Everybody experiences that. And at the time of birth, you're acutely aware of its opposite. And we know that when a person dies, he's reborn. So it is in that vein that I'm talking about the law of opposites. Jung himself was a man of many opposite talents. Just to give you a little background, he was a great scholar, a Swiss psychiatrist, wrote 17 volumes, explored the unconscious, coined the term extroversion, introversion, explored dreams, worked with patients, was a great scholar. At the same time, he was a stonemason, gourmet cook, and a man who, when he sat on his stone wall, I forgot the picture, looked just like a farmer that you might meet anywhere. So he had both sides in himself and developed both his inner life and his outer life so that he was as close to a whole person as I have come across. Now back to the areas where opposites occur in your psyche. We have talked about the fact that you cannot live only in your conscious life. The ego, which is your consciousness, is a very small portion of your whole self. The unconscious, the collective unconscious, is a much larger portion, and the unconscious and the conscious are in constant tension of opposites. To explain a little more, the conscious ego has the task of dealing with the world, being logical, being oriented to the here and now, time, material things, decisions, whatever. It is the mediator to the outer world. The unconscious is filled with archetypes, is timeless, is quite non-rational, and acts as a guide if you will listen to your dreams. It is constantly beaming messages to your conscious life if through dreams. And that's why it is so important to listen to your, to record and listen to the messages of your dreams, since the dreams contain a kind of wisdom that is far beyond your conscious self. Our Bible is filled with the importance of dreams, and in primitive societies, people who are close to their unconscious and who understand and can interpret dreams are raised to high status, are the wise old men of the tribe. And I think Joseph in the Old Testament, when he interpreted the dreams, was such a man. Wasn't it Pharaoh came to him and asked him to interpret the dreams? And they contain the kernels of wisdom that can guide us in our conscious life. Not just dreams, but mythology and fairy tales also contain this wisdom in various forms. And I would just say that reading fairy tales to your children is one of the best ways to raise them, rather than letting them watch TV. They will absorb more wisdom and be able to deal with the problem of violence better than if they watch too many cartoons, but that gets off somewhere else. There's a saying that Freud used and that Jung accepted as well. Freud and Jung collaborated for about 6 years and would have probably continued to collaborate had they not fallen out over the interpretation of, yes, you guessed it, a dream. And Freud was quite a bit older. He was a pioneer. But he had defined the unconscious as the place of the id, which was all sexual, and of the death wish, death, well, thanatos, the death wish, or this need for desire for destroying yourself. So that, in terms of the way Jung saw it, it was only the personal unconscious and only the negative side. He gave very little space to the creative, to the spiritual, and to the forward-looking aspects of the psyche. Anyhow, between Freud and Jung, there was a falling out, and Jung then proceeded to develop his own brand of psychotherapy, and today there is a growing awareness of his great contribution, since he was aware of trends. He said things that today are applicable. You'd think he had lived in the 70s and 80s, the way his writings read, and I recommend highly the book Man and His Symbols, which was written for people who are not psychologists, for people who are not going to be psychotherapists or anything like that, but who are just ordinary laymen. And he wrote it also upon the inspiration of a dream, or listening to a dream, when he had been approached by John Freeman of the BBC to write a popular book. He shook his head and he said, oh no, I'm not going to do it. I'm too old. He was 83, I guess. And he said, no, and of course John Freeman left. Then that night he dreamt, or the next night he dreamt, that he was standing in the marketplace. And there was a great crowd of blue-collar workers. And they were listening to him speak in English, and they understood what he had to say. It was, and they understood what he had to say, that really shook him, because his German is convoluted, and no matter what you do, it's hard going. So the next day he called John Freeman and he said, well, I think I will do it. And he spent the next 10 months writing this article in Man and His Symbols, the first chapter, in English, and editing it. Finished it about 10 days before he died. I wasn't very inspired by that. And the collaborators have written other chapters, and the last chapter deals with with a Jungian analysis. It goes through how an analysis proceeds and says there is no such thing as a typical analysis, but this is presented as an example. As I said before, the unconscious sends constant messages to the conscious and increases the awareness of what is going on in the psyche so that it acts as a guide. But there's always a tension. And all dreams are compensatory, so that if you are in a very good place, especially here at Holden, totally relaxed and happy, you may have horrendous dreams, horrible dreams, scary dreams, because you're suddenly open to the unconscious. Also, depending on how close you are to your unconscious to begin with, you will be more open to remembering some of these dreams. We dream every night. It's just a question of whether we remember them. If you're in a very bad place, you're going through a crisis and you're struggling, you may have a dream that will point towards a solution. And again, here is the opposites that can be seen in a dream, which contain the seeds of the solution. And this is how Jungians interpret dreams. We look for the two opposites of the conflict and see if there's any solution indicated, if it's pointing anywhere, where is it leading us to, what can you learn from this? Very similar to how we should, I think, read the scriptures, say, what can I learn from this, and what we can learn from suffering. So this first area of opposites is the conscious and the unconscious, okay? Second is male and female. That's what Larry announced at the lunch today. Jung called the female aspect anima, male aspect animus. These are that they are archetypes, okay? They're what you have in your unconscious. If you're a man, you will have an unconscious anima. You'll have a female image, feminine tendencies, nurturing tendencies, and these are the polar opposite of your conscious male orientation. If you are a woman, you have a masculine image, a masculine achievement drive, a masculine animus in your psyche, which will be the counterpart to your conscious feminine adjustment. The first step in becoming aware of this is the falling in love. This animus is taken by a woman, put on a man, and suddenly this man is transfigured. You're in love. He's just everything. I mean, your heart beats faster when you're in his presence, and everything he says and does is just wonderful because of this projection of this energy. There's a lot of energy. And sooner or later, you have to recognize that this person is a human being with faults, clay feet, bad habits, what have you. And the disillusionment sets in, and you pull back the projection, and you say, sorry, I don't think it's going to work. However, if you're lucky and you've projected this image onto somebody who seems to emerge from this pulling back of the projection and still is a pretty nice person, then you can work a relationship and you can have a love relationship. You're no longer in love, you have a love relationship. Similarly, and I'll spell out for the, what was I talking about? Which one did I talk about? Yeah. The man in turn has the anima that he puts on a woman, falls in love, she's absolutely wonderful, and the same thing happens. Sooner or later, she emerges as a person with certain habits that may or may not fit, and he's no longer in love, but has to build a love relationship with the anima. In himself, his task is to recognize the opposite, as a woman has to recognize her animus, and to develop it, and not to let another person live it out for you. So this tension goes through our whole life and is something that we need to work on. As I was writing my outline, it came to me that in the Bible it opens with Genesis and it says, male and female, he created them. And then he looks about and says, it was very good. All the other creations were good, but the male and female, he said, was very good. I kind of like that. So we have to live with these opposites, and they are creative. The tension of opposites is always a creative, energy-releasing experience. The other day, now I'm coming to a third aspect of opposites. The other day we talked about extroversion and introversion. Those are terms that Jung coined. Extroversion being the tendency for you to put your psychic energy out there and to be at home in the outer world and to go from one act to another with a quick, with a quick transition, easily from one to the next. Not necessarily hail fellow well met at all, but you could be a mechanic or you could be a person who works with things for whom the inner life is paradoxical, threatening, and odd. And you don't spend much time writing diaries, writing poetry, looking inside. The introvert, in turn, is at home with his inner life and may be very, very warm towards people, but is not very well acquainted with the outer world because he has to process every experience. It takes a lot of time to process every experience, tends to write diaries, tends to need a lot of time to analyze his inner life. And there are no value judgments. In our culture, however, we favor the extrovert and we look down upon and think sometimes the introvert is not with it, as they say. I think in the first half of life, we all need to deal with our immediate tasks. We have to know where we're going, what kind of job, and what our worldly duties are, and we have to be able to deal with that. But in the second half of life, Jung says, it is essential that you become more introverted and look to your inner life. That's where growth takes place. Now, one little phrase that you can remember is, the whole process of growth is one of becoming more and more aware of what goes on in your inner life, and the libido or the id, which is psychic energy, becomes more conscious. And there's a phrase that we always bandy about, where id was, there shall ego be. Do you follow? Where unconsciousness was, there shall be consciousness. Gradually, as you grow, you become more and more conscious, more and more aware, you integrate more things into your psyche. And this is known the process of individuation. This goes on all your life, and I'll talk about it more next week. It's a fascinating spiral growth that goes on, and we have to go over the same territory over and over again, but each time with a little accrued wisdom, hopefully. And my favorite way of looking at it is that we're riding in a car, this is a metaphor, riding in a train backwards, so that we're always looking with our back to the front, you know, which I'm riding this way, and my picture is constantly widening. So every day I can put in a new piece into this puzzle and see a constantly enlarging picture. This is a bit of Chinese wisdom I picked up on the way for it. But instead of peering into the future and trying to figure out what's happening, sit back and let, you can't know what's ahead of you or behind you anyhow. Look to the past and see how things fit together. And there's another way of growing and learning. In the unconscious and in dreams, you will come across symbols, people, archetypes, and these are always paired and opposites. You will have things like the Great Mother, nurturing, giving, loving, juxtaposed, or the opposite is the witch, the devouring mother, the one who even eats her own offspring. I mean, these, like in fairy tales, these opposites are always there. You may have figures that are the wise old man. Man is a philosopher, has a lot of wisdom, counterpoised with a devilish trickster, one who is sly and tries to trick you up, and instead of giving you wisdom, gives you takes you in the dangerous places. So there are many opposites in your dreams, which as you become more acquainted, you will learn to recognize. It's essential that you recognize the fact that opposites are creative, or release creative energy. The more there is a tension of opposites, the more energy is available for a creative solution. This is the main point that I'd like to make for you to think about. And before we go on, I'd like to hear from somebody. If you have any questions, or if I'm not clear, or if there's anything.
You said that the more opposites that are available, the more energy that's created?
The more the tension of opposites. The greater the tension of opposites.
Okay.
Yeah. For instance, some people think, back to the male-female, that if you're perfectly androgynous, or if you have perfectly balanced male-female, that's an ideal. In some ways it is, but in some other ways there is not enough tension, and you're neither female nor male. See? And in many marriages, you know, there are these really opposite types that are very attracted to each other. That's part of that tension of opposite. And in friendships, you are more likely to go with somebody who's very much like yourself. Very much like yourself. Like sex, like-minded, and similar type. Outlook on life. But in marriage, somehow, for reasons that I explained earlier, you're attracted to the opposite. Yeah?
I watched a very skilled therapist, Virginia Satir. She's very skilled, and what she does is redefine the opposite when a person is petulant or negative. For example, if a person has just tried to take their life, she might say to them, you have been very brave to have lived your life this long. In such a struggle, so that, or if they're extremely angry, she might say, there's tremendous creative energy in that. Always looking at the opposite side, which the person can reclaim and use.
And she's a therapist?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But it's a wonderful habit that anybody can develop, to redefine the negative to the positive.
Yes, very, very, very true. And I try as often as possible to look for the opposite when somebody comes in at one extreme, to to hold up the other side. And especially when the person is depressed, the image that has worked both for me and for others is that if you want to build a very tall building, you have to dig a very deep, excavation, basement. So the depth of the depression can often foreshadow the heights to which you may grow. However, this doesn't mean that you should go through the ups and downs, but seeing the opposite, especially in the dark times, is essential and very important. Yes?
Well, what if you can't define whether you are either extrovert or introvert? You just feel like you're one time one and another time another.
We all are. We go from one to another, but one we feel at home in and the other one we have to strain. And you can begin to notice when you feel more comfortable. Now I'm really myself. I feel, you know, when I'm sitting there meditating, I feel I'm totally myself. But in another situation, I feel a little more uncomfortable. I do it. Did somebody have a question back
there? Isn't it a conscious, unconscious dichotomy, like the opposite of you there?
Yeah, well, all right, we will talk about types again next week, but let us say if you are thinking type, then the unconscious would hold the feeling, and it would be very infantile, it would be childish, it would be undifferentiated, it would burst forth in temper. Jung himself was a thinking intuitive type, and he had his feeling was in the unconscious, and he was aware of his weakness, his shadow, his opposite. So he said to everyone, please, you have to bear with my temper. I cannot change it. So becoming aware of your opposite and of your weakness can help you live a smoother life. You can't change it, but you can say to others, well, this is my weakness. I'm sure all of you have done it more or less. You know where your Achilles heels are. Yes?
I would say, in other words, when you say you cannot change it, where does this relate to your own discipline? Your, in other words, knowing and perceiving the various aspects of self and bringing that under some discipline. Is there, if I hear you correctly, maybe not, that discipline is not that strong in relationship to that?
Well, I don't know if I dealt with discipline. Discipline would be a way of keeping your boundaries such that you wouldn't let your impulses carry you hither and yon, so that this would be a rational approach, and you'd be keeping your non-rational self under control and discipline, which we have to do in order to live a rational life. If we keep the control too tight, something's going to burst out somewhere. We're going to have trouble. If we keep it too loose, allow it to be too loose, people will begin to say, my God, you know, all over. And the dangers are just as great at both. One is a repressed person who's afraid of his creativity, and the other one is a what we call psychopath who cannot discipline himself at all. We as adults have to use discipline to keep the boundaries firm but not too tight.
One more question based on that. Then I'm constantly involved in playing games with myself, and this idea of discipline. Can I really then only know that true balance unless someone helps me to recognize where I'm really at in terms of too much or too little discipline then?
Mm.
How honest can I really be with myself?
Well, that will depend on how much you want to work on understanding yourself and how smooth and difficult your life has been. There are times in life where we really have to seek help, and I think that today we are much more able to go to seek help before we fall apart, because there are difficult times in life where we need help, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a psychiatrist. It could be a very good friend if our trouble isn't too deep and too complex. I think being honest with yourself is essential. I don't know how honest you are with yourself. This I cannot answer, but I think it is possible to do it by yourself. And, unless you are going through very difficult times, I think it can be done, especially if you pay attention to your dreams and your unconscious.
Just in response to what you're saying, to me, discipline means that you're discipled. And the Christ is the one that lets you know where the balance is, and then by keeping in touch with that inner block, you then create that balance between the unconscious and the conscious, or whatever, or the too much structure, too little, and that's the whole meaning of being perfect, is to get your act together.
See, that's lovely. I never heard that. We always think perfectionism, you see, is not what is meant by being perfect at all. That's going too far in the tight control. Yeah.
Just given that your comment about being an opposite, that you often bring the opposite to
your conscious.
Your conscious is thinking, yes, okay. But then you said something about it's there with the solution to whatever problem or your concept of mind is working on.
In the dream.
Can you talk a little bit more about how to sort of get it?
All right. I'll get you in. Just a minute, I'll get you. The most famous example is when the chemist was, Kekula?
Kekula.
Was thinking about the benzene ring, and he couldn't solve it, and day in and day out he was working on it. And in a dream he had this vision of a circle or a snake biting its tail, which is a healing symbol in itself, but suddenly, and he woke up and he thought, why, this is maybe the way I should arrange the molecules, and when he did, there was a benzene ring, which has been very famous. This is an example of the unconscious working in your sleep and bringing you the solution. What I was talking about is a little different. Every dream, big dream, has a sort of drama. They're the protagonist, and then there is a solution hinted at. And it's like you were saying, looking for the opposite. You may be going through a very dark corridor into a lighted house. That would be an example of it. Or you might be going through there are many. You'd have to bring a specific dream for me to give you an example of that. But the opposites in the dream often give a hint as to what the solution is going to be.
Sometimes the dreams are so crazy.
Yeah, they are, because they're non-rational. They're non-rational by definition. Yeah. And the reason we have ignored them so much is that we are in a rational culture where dreams are undervalued, where everything non-rational or irrational is regarded as crazy. And we don't want to be crazy. But they are not crazy. They are non-rational. They have their own laws, and their own laws are precisely the law of opposite, of paradox. And I think the Bible is filled with paradox. I think Jesus was talking this language, and this is why I'm so excited about it, because it is the same language that is in the Bible.
I was just going to come into the gentleman over here. You said something about discipline. I thought you were talking about self-discipline on yourself. You said you do games to yourself. It seems to me that by disciplining yourself already, you have an honest perception of what something is that you need to keep in control of. And that you're already being honest with yourself because you're using the discipline to do that.
Does that kind of... Thank you. Yeah.
If sometimes dreams point to solutions, do we always know the problems? It's like, you have dreams when the real problem of the dream is just to figure out what it means, let alone a solution or how it relates to your own.
Yeah. That takes a lot of time, and usually more than one dream on a theme. Mm-hmm. And there are these recurring dreams that come to you that give you these both warnings and guides. Mm-hmm. That I would like to give an example that I find worked in my own life. I've kept track of my dreams for over 20 years and tabulated them and analyzed them, and I've been through analysis, so it's my profession, so anyhow. I live very closely to them, but the most clear example was when, back about 15 years ago or more, I had the dream of being in the kitchen, which is the place of transformation, incidentally. And I hate, now this is in reality, I hate working in the kitchen. I hate housework of every kind. Well, in this dream, the priest came and took my hand and said, you must work with love and thanksgiving. And he moved around in a beautiful circle. And I woke up and I said, oh, how wonderful. And I went in there, hunched my shoulders, and I worked with love and thanksgiving. It took me 15 years or so to really do it. You see, it took a long time. You can't will it, you see, but the message was there. Now, this is a very specific example that has actually taken a long time for me to hear, though I knew it in my head all along, as you know, you see.
One of the basic problems is that it's the, what do you call it, the depth of the symbolism that's involved in dreaming. You spoke about the benzene circle. The normal person has that dream, wonders what in the world snakes have to do with it. And forget the circle.
Yeah, but this was a genius.
This is a very simple one, where in reality aren't most dreams so highly symbolic.
Many
a lay person gets very, you just don't get very far. You don't understand what it's all about, and then you're going to.
Well, yes. What happens if you begin to look at your own dreams? There are recurring people and recurring symbols, and next week I'll talk again about symbols. They're sort of shorthand for you to recognize what's going on. I don't want to get into all the symbols right now, but there are things like crossing thresholds, what happens at the threshold, what happens in the house, and so forth, that are pretty universal. But snakes, I might as well talk about now, are a healing symbol. And a healing symbol, snakes, and especially a snake biting its own tail. A symbol for the doctor is the intertwining snakes, and that's no accident. If a snake bites you, it often means that you're making very painful
Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so it shall not be lifted up.
Yeah.
That's a strange part of the Bible, isn't it?
Yeah. When a snake bites you, I was saying, you're making painful contact with the unconscious, the snake representing the
Shelley used snakes as a positive thing in dreams, which as a positive thing in poetry. I don't know whether it came to him in dreams or not. He was against everyone in his age, in the sense that no one else in 1815 made snakes a positive way as unions do.
Mm-hmm.
And many, and Shelley incidentally thought of incest as something as a delightful subject for poetry too. That's
yeah, that is. But while we're on an aspect of sex, when you are dreaming a dream of embracing, kissing, having sexual intercourse with a person, it is interpreted by Jungian dream interpreters not as wanting to have an affair with this person, but wanting to take some of the qualities into yourself. And what it is you admire, love, want to incorporate of this person into yourself. Thus also when you embrace same-sex people, it doesn't have that same implication. It means that you want to, that you admire that person's qualities, and you need that to complement yourself. Yeah?
Well, I don't understand why these symbols, they're universal symbols, you said, but if you haven't had that experience in yourself as say, a snake in a circle as being a healing thing, how would that come out in your inner dream as something that you yourself experienced, or something that you, I don't know what I'm making myself plain.
No, I don't quite understand that.
Well, why would a symbol like that be, to me, a healing symbol? What if I thought of the snake as being the garden, a symbol of evil?
Right. Okay, I think I know what you're saying. Why, if you were deathly afraid and your conscious mind had only associated the snake with Satan in the garden, all right, then if you had this dream and you brought it into me in a therapy session, I would ask you for your associations. And if your associations were all negative, I would have to buy into that, but also point out to you that universally they're also healing symbols, and then you could accept or reject it, you see. In all cases, we try to talk to the person, ask them for their personal associations, and not to jump in with our own idea. Jung said he left all his learning behind and tried to talk to the center of the person when he was in the therapeutic relationship with them, and try to understand where they were coming from. I love that quote of him. Where are you coming from? What does it mean to you? And then in the whole therapeutic relationship, we try to help the person to help themselves. We try not to give advice. And that's the big difference between a friendship relationship and a therapeutic relationship. A friend we'll commiserate, we'll give sympathy, we'll say, and then I think you should do this and so, and why don't you do this, and this and so forth. Where the therapist will say, it looks to me that this is what you're struggling with, and these are the possibilities, and then encourages the client to choose the way they want to go, even if he may think this may not be the right way. They have to learn, just like you have a child learn through experience. But if he's going to do something terribly dangerous, you would stop, you would try to prevent it. Just as you would a child, you don't let them cross the street in traffic, but you let them experiment on the level that they are at and with the readiness that they are at. Every person is ready to hear the messages on different levels. As I said, we go on a spiral of growth. And waiting for the readiness of the person is what we have to learn as a skill, and that you have to intuit. You cannot just barge in with all the knowledge that you have. The person just can't receive it, can't process it. Any questions?
In relation to her question, you ask about associations with a particular symbol like snakes. How universal is that symbol then, if association, personal or individual associations, are important in interpreting?
Okay, and then again, the opposite. No, no, they are. They're both unique and universal. They have another opposite, you see.
But that's almost mutually exclusive, isn't it?
Not really.
Universal and individual.
They're universal symbols individually closed, so to speak.
Oh, in other words, everybody may dream about snakes, but snakes mean different
things. Yeah. And when you dream of an archetype of the Great Mother, it may come to you in different forms. Each person will have their own individual image. And depending on what culture you're in, somebody last week said, I dream of people with powdered wigs. And turned out she was a historian and a history major, and that she was very much into, I think, a historical novel. So she dreamt of these people with powdered wigs and costumes. And that was the way she saw the people in her particular dream at that time. I'm sure that you've all had, I'd urge you all to try to remember your dreams. Do you think I should go over how we can remember them? Yes. Well, you cannot will to remember them, but you can suggest to yourself that you will try pretty hard. You have 4 or 5 dreams every night, so the material is there. It's not jumping into the day with such vehemence. In other words, you're lying in bed and it's morning, and instead of opening your eyes and looking around and saying, well, now let's see, today I have to give a session at 4 o'clock and I wonder what Larry's going to announce, etc., or when do we have to catch the boat, whatever. Or if you're working, have to be at work. Naturally, this is what we have to deal with on the outside. Instead of that, lie in bed, keep your eyes closed, and do not think, if that's possible. Just let the images rise, sort of doze, you know, that dozing period, and allow about 3 to 5 minutes. Have a pencil and paper by the bed and your glasses, if you wear glasses. Kind of important. I've scribbled many a dream without glasses, and they were almost unreadable. And then let it sit. Let it sit. Do not try to analyze them right away. Let it sort of live, let it ride with you. If it's a big dream, you won't even have to write it down. That will shake you and keep coming back. But these small dreams, depending how seriously one does, they're all there, and the images, if it's only an image, write down the image. You can draw it. Don't edit. I was told by my analyst that I had a tendency to edit my dreams. And I sort of want to edit out the ugly parts. You know, like when I went to the bathroom and left the door open. That wasn't important. Well, everything's important in a dream. You know, you take it seriously. And I would like to share with you the one dream that exemplifies opposites that one of my clients brought to me and also gave me permission to share. He was out in the woods at a lake where the sewage was flowing into this, or the water. The water was sewage water. It was real awful. And he was digging, and as he was digging, he found a gold coin, and he found a silver coin. And there was the opposite. In the mire and the muck, he found the precious coins. And I thought that was a very good omen, because they were the opposites, you see. That's an example of it in a dream.
Now, what, if I may ask, did you help him to see in that? In other words, what was the point that followed after that?
Well, he's a poet who had trouble had what we call writer's block, and he was working too hard, working too many hours. He couldn't come to himself. He didn't know how to sit down and really write. And I pointed out to him that the coins, we talked about it a lot of time, was sort of the creativity that was buried in all this. And that since he was digging up all these precious things, maybe he made himself space and time to write, which he later did, very soon did. And he has the gift. It's just he couldn't get himself to do it. That was a very specific application. I work mostly with artists right now, myself. Yeah?
About the most dramatic case in history of a great and wonderful man who went insane was John Swift. And Swift, throughout his life, could not reconcile the fact that our bodies are animal bodies, vertebrate mammals with an immortal soul. I don't know what he would have done if Emily had been his worked with him, but Swift was driven crazy by this. And Swift never married. Every time he was in love with a woman, he would think of her bodily functions, and it would just... And so he spent his last time as a drooling, babbling idiot. Insanity is historically a fashionable. One age has one kind of insanity and one another. One funny clip about Freud's patients, I'll get to the point in a hurry, Emily, is that Freud first worked with upper class Jewish women who had hysteria, some kind of sexual problem that I don't know what they were, but and somebody said Freud based his psychology on these hysterical patients. And really, one should not base it on the Viennese bedroom. And one wit says, yes, but they were fairly large bedrooms. for universal implications.
Thank you. You always bring levity to my seriousness. Yes?
You know, some of us won't be here next week, and I wondered if you could just give us a quick, brief summary of the main symbols and what they mean.
Okay. Let me haul out my little sheet here. I can do it by heart, but I'd rather do it in a more organized way. I also have the tape, but I think, I can do a sort of summary. Maybe we should start with the house. That the house, again, I preface this by saying this is by and large. The house usually means the psyche. And exploring new rooms would mean looking, having new areas to develop, new places, new spaces in the psyche. Going upstairs, tell me if I'm going too fast, or that. Going upstairs would be becoming more conscious, going down into the basement to the unconscious, or going downstairs. This was the kind of difficulty that Jung and Freud had, because Freud explained everything sexually. Crossing a threshold is very important. It means that you're going from one phase of your life to the next, and what happens at the threshold. The path that you travel, the nature of the path would be a symbol of the process of individuation of where you're going in your life. Dangerous paths that are blocked, very obvious. Sometimes you have to make a detour. Detours are very important in life. And when you make a detour in your dream, it often tells you that you must go around an obstacle rather than butting your head against it. Some doors remain closed. They probably should remain closed. Many fairy tales have closed doors. Those are areas that you should leave alone. Vessels. If they're empty, it probably means that you've drained your energy to the point where you need to recharge your batteries, refill your psyche. It's a very small thing sometimes, but I had a number of dreams where my vessels were always empty. There was no water in them, or there was no wine, or no whatever. Something is lacking. Any lack often speaks of drained energy. Spending money is giving out energy. Receiving money is receiving energy. And you can become real specific about the amounts. If you're getting a bargain in a dream, it's not as good as in the world, because you're getting something for less. You're giving less energy than to this thing than it really is worth. And that's always fascinating. The way you travel, very important. If you walk, you're using your own energy to move yourself forward. If you're riding in a car, you're more passive, you're being moved. If you're flying in an airplane or any other contraption, it often means ambition. And I always bring up the myth of Icarus, Daedalus and Icarus, who flew too high to the sun, and then the wax melted and he tumbled into the sea. Flying too high and crashing is self-evident that you're trying too much. Swimming in the water is being immersed in the unconscious. Riding in a boat, in a sailboat, especially with the wind blowing, the wind is often the spirit floating over the unconscious. And riding in a steamer on the water would again be a passive mode of adjustment. And riding on top of the unconscious, not really getting your hands or feet or anything wet. Again, these are very general things, you understand, but they are also universal. So everything has this tensionality. The shadow is often, the shadow side of yourself is often shown by dark figures, dark threatening figures, people who come to steal some of your jewels, break into your house. People breaking into your house, by and large, are the shadow figures. Fire, car crashes, any danger, often anxiety. And especially if you see the flames very vividly. The child, what a child does, the age of the child, giving birth to a child. Archetype of your own child in you, that which is growing, that creative side of you, which you need to develop. And the age of the child is very important, because you can go back and ask in a therapeutic situation, what happened to you at the age? This is where we go back to childhood. What happened when you were age 3 if you just had a big dream about this 3-year-old? You see. Again, if you are the mother of a 3-year-old, and your 3-year-old has been troubling you all day, it has a different meaning. You see, that's why we always have to test it out where you're at. And my favorite one is, if you're a spelunker and you've been exploring caves all day, then going into a cave is not a universal symbol, it's just reworking his life. So, the mode that you're in, if you're sitting, you take it as more passive. If you're walking, and as I mentioned already, it's more active. The active-passive dimension is very important. And then the shapes, the universal symbols of the cross, the circle, dancing in the circle. We were talking about Sarah's circle earlier. That is mentioned in the Matthew Fox book. Anything in the circle, any round object, receiving bracelets, receiving jewelry is wonderful. Precious stones, being given a precious stone. The stone is often a symbol of the psyche, the self. And the circle and the square are symbols of the self. And Jung has written extensively on the meaning of the quaternity, the four sides. We have the Trinity, and then we have the fourth, which is wholeness, completeness, something about the balance of four sides of something that is four-sided. And if you have a circle inside a square, you already have a mandala, which is a symbol of wholeness. I was going to talk about, I did talk about that, and we'll talk about that again. Mandala is a symbol of wholeness of the self. Symbol of wholeness of the self. So much for a thumbnail sketch, quick overview. Is that helpful?
Yeah. What is
falling? Oh, falling, often anxiety, especially in young, in adolescence. It's a most common dream, and it often has something to do with the rapid physiological growth. And people often wake up before they fall, especially if they're falling from great heights, before they hurt themselves. The ability to wake yourself up before something terrible happens is often a way of keeping yourself from facing the ultimate outcome of some disaster. It may just be that you have conscious control, you're sleeping lightly. And to bring it to the physiological level, if you're dreaming that you're lying there, the railroad train's coming and you can't move, it may well be that your leg has fallen asleep. Okay?
Yeah, and you mentioned that flying with some sort of contraption because it's, you know, possibly passive.
Oh.
How about if you're flying without anything, just yourself?
Yeah, that's wonderful. Flying by yourself, that is a both a wonderful feeling and a sign that you're able to rise above. You take these things quite literally, rise above what's down below. And if you don't crash, it's really quite good. I had one where I was able to fly about this high above the ground. So nice, I felt the wind blowing. But I was flying against the wind. It was awfully hard, so I just had to turn around and fly with the wind. It was much easier. See, turning around and going with the stream. Similarly, I had a dream of swimming against the stream, and after several tries, I decided it would be better to swim with the stream. And it was that wonderful feeling of going with the stream, you see. So, pretty awesome. Yeah.
Well, I think the other day I hardly remember a dream, but every once in a while I do wake up having had a sense of falling. Is that the tail end of a dream I'm avoiding?
It could be. It could be that you have the sensation of falling because it's part of a dream that you can't remember, but this is so powerful that it wakes you. And there's a whole set of physiological things that happen that cause you to wake up. And you see, a dream really keeps you asleep, but if it's too strong, if the whatever is happening to your body is too strong, it'll wake you up. But I wouldn't put that in the classification of dreams. I'd call that a physiological reaction. Just as walking in your sleep is not a nightmare, but a night terror. It's a way of something that you're not conscious of, you have no control over. But that's a different area.
When I was a boy, I had a morning paper out, and the company told me that if I overslept one more time, they would fire me. And what happened was I had two alarms, and I put them in wash tubs. And every time the alarms would go off, my mind would make up a story. I was on the farm, and mules were braying one night. And another time the alarm went off, and it was my sister raking leaves. And a third time, my mother was washing the dishes. And so, as long as my mind could make up a story, I stayed asleep.
Yes, and very good. That's exactly what happened. The sound will come, and you will incorporate it in your sleep and make up a story about it. That's always kind of fun. Well, it's 3 minutes to the bell, and it's been fun. I'll see you next. I think it's in the evening that I'll be talking next week, and it'll be on the bulletin board.